again. Welcome to Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris, and we've been doing some podcasts on questions that we get at reasonablefaith.org. A couple of good questions today that we're going to deal with, one dealing with evolution and some related issues, and another dealing with skepticism. Two good questions that we'll talk to Dr. Craig about today. In the meantime, be sure that you go to reasonablefaith.org. A couple of things we want you to consider. First, you can start a Reasonable Faith chapter in your area if there's not one already. Now, Reasonable Faith chapters are springing up all over the world and from coast to coast here in the States. You can get information on starting a Reasonable Faith chapter when you go to reasonablefaith.org. Also, we'd like for you to consider partnering with us as we continue this ministry. Get all the information there on how you can support us prayerfully and financially. That's reasonablefaith.org. Michael writes, Dr. Craig, I'm a continentally trained philosophy student. I'm also a big fan of yours, but ultimately, my allegiance is with the skeptics of both Christianity and the existence of God. I have two unrelated questions for you. Let's take the first one here. First, my question is, where do I stand in the eyes of Jesus? If Christianity is true and I was to die tomorrow, then what would be my status? Because I've given good effort to come to an intellectual conclusion, and my efforts led me to disbelief. If I die now, then am I to be deprived of God? In other words, is God going to still hold him to blame even though he's done his best to come to the conclusion that God exists?
Well, the New Testament is pretty clear about this, Kevin. Paul says in his first chapter to the church in Rome that from nature alone, God's existence is evident to all persons everywhere at any time in history. So he says that people are without excuse for their unbelief. He says what can be known about God is evident to them because God has shown it to them, and that therefore no one has a just excuse before God for not believing in him and repenting of sin and turning to God for forgiveness. Jesus said something similar. He said, if any man's will is to do God's will, then he will know whether my teaching is from God or whether I'm just speaking on my own authority. Here Jesus said that it is the orientation of a person's will that will ultimately determine his belief, and that if a person's will is genuinely to seek God, to find God, that person will recognize that Jesus is from God and that he's not just speaking on his own. So I take it that God, through his Holy Spirit and his witness in nature, has provided ample grounds for people to respond affirmatively to the revelation of God that he has given to them, and that therefore everyone is without excuse who turns his back on that revelation, no matter how diligently they may think they have tried. In other words, human beings are incredibly capable of self-deception and self-rationalization. Studies have shown this over and over again, how we rationalize things and deceive ourselves. And I imagine that many unbelievers fancy themselves to have diligently and sincerely sought God and then turned away from him, and therefore imagine themselves excused before God for their unbelief. And the message of the New Testament is that that's simply not true. They have turned away from him because their hearts do not truly seek him. Their hearts are oriented toward some other good rather than the ultimate good toward God, and that's why they don't believe. Now, if this person is sincerely seeking God, then I think that God will lead that person to faith in Christ. It's not as though that person's life is going to end tomorrow. If God knew that by prolonging this person's life a little longer, that person would come to faith, I think God would let that person live a little longer. Because God says that if you seek me, you will find me. And Jesus promised the same thing. If you seek, you will find. So if this person is seeking sincerely and honestly, I'd want to encourage him to keep on seeking, keep on looking, and I think he will find, he will come to faith if he'll do so sincerely with an open mind and heart.
I think this is very important, and I've heard it referred to as just keeping God up on the blackboard. You know, so that you can always examine and re-examine and wait for more evidence to come in and then discount that evidence and bring this evidence in. And standards of evidence change from person to person and from era to era and keep God as kind of an intellectual game. But that's not how we do personal relationships, and it's certainly not how we do faith, you've said.
Well, that's absolutely right. And Paul Moser has really emphasized this very well in his work on theism and religious epistemology. Moser has just emphasized over and over again that it is matters of the heart, the disposition of the will, whether one is willing to approach God with humility and contrition and to come to God on his terms rather than to come to God on your own terms, to come to him on the standards that the skeptic sets. And I suspect that a great many people have simply deceive themselves into thinking that they are seeking God in an appropriate way. And in fact, they're seeking God in a kind of idolatrous way that seeks to make God conform to their standards and their image rather than seeking him in genuine humility and contrition. If we will seek him in that way, then I think we will come to faith.
He asked an unrelated question. Dr. Craig, he says, within your apologetics, you often refer to authoritative opinion to support your arguments. Nothing wrong with that, right? Examples of such references can be found within your writings concerning the cosmological, theological, or resurrection arguments. Yet, when it comes to biological evolution, you side with the very small minority of scientists. In fact, you side with the faction that is largely determined to be pseudoscience, that is, intelligent design. So my question is this. If there are sufficient grounds to believe in the 4 to 5 facts you expound concerning Jesus' resurrection, merely because the bulk of New Testament scholars affirm its historic veracity, then why not the same with biological evolution?
All right, there are a number of issues that are intertwined here. First of all, I do not advocate believing in these 4 facts pertinent to Jesus' resurrection, simply because this is the majority opinion of New Testament scholarship. I give reasons for each of those facts, multiple lines of evidence in support of those facts. And then summarizing, what I will say is, in fact, these facts or this evidence is found convincing by the majority of New Testament scholars today.
Okay, so there's a proper appeal to authority and an improper appeal to authority.
Certainly, and with respect to the resurrection, there is in no way a simple appeal to authority on which it ends, at least not in my published work. Now, sometimes in a talk, that's very true that one will have to give summary statements. But if you look, for example, at my book, Assessing the New Testament Evidence for the Historicity of the Resurrection of Jesus, you'll see these multiple lines of evidence laid out. They're also laid out in Reasonable Faith, too, on a more popular level. And what I try to do is to communicate to students that these are not just my peculiar opinions. It's not just Bill Craig who finds this evidence convincing. It is the majority of New Testament scholars today that find this convincing. So it is simply an attempt to show students who aren't themselves familiar with the evidence that this evidence has convinced more than just me personally. It's convinced the majority of scholars. Now, when it comes to biological evolution, what we have to ask ourselves is, what do you mean by biological evolution? Francisco Ayala, who is an eminent evolutionary biologist, distinguishes 3 aspects of evolutionary theory in this regard. First is what he calls evolution. And by that, he simply means descent with modification, that living organisms are descended with changes from earlier organisms. And he says it is in that sense that biologists say evolution is an incontrovertible fact. And of course, virtually everyone agrees with mere descent by modification. Secondly, though, he talks about what he calls evolutionary history, and this would be tracing the lineages of biological organisms back in time to construct a universal tree of life that goes back to a primordial ancestor. Now, that assumes the thesis of common ancestry, that all living life forms are descended from a common ancestor, and that is much more controversial than the simple fact of evolution. The third aspect of evolutionary theory that it distinguishes is the mechanisms of evolution. That is to say, what explains evolution? And this is genetic mutation and natural selection. This is what he calls Darwinism. This is Darwin's discovery. Now, Ayala says that point one is beyond dispute. Everyone, he says, agrees with evolution so defined. But when it comes to point two and point three, he says these are matters of open scientific investigation. And he says with regard to the third in particular, he says, although some things are known, many things are unknown, many are merely conjectural, and he says many we have no idea about whatsoever. So that puts a very different spin on the situation. My skepticism about evolutionary theory, or my openness to alternatives like intelligent design, is primarily focused on the third element. I'm simply not convinced that it has been demonstrated that random genetic mutation coupled with natural selection is sufficient to produce this amount of biological complexity today. And I'm very open to the evidence. If I can be shown the evidence that it could do that, then I would embrace that. I have no theological axe to grind here whatsoever. So I think that when you properly understand the term, skepticism about point three is not at all pseudoscience. On the contrary, this is an open scientific question. And a good many evolutionary theorists themselves think that we don't have the complete story, that there is a lot more going on to explain evolution and common descent than mere random genetic mutation and natural selection, that those mechanisms, in fact, are not sufficient.
Let's revisit then quickly a proper appeal to authority and an improper appeal. I mean, when you argue for the resurrection, you give this evidence and then bring in as part of that evidence or in support of that evidence the consensus of scholarship. You wouldn't hold to the consensus of naturalistic scientists on matters of theology because you have other arguments that you think negate their naturalistic assumptions?
Well, with respect to, say, that third point about Darwinism, there, one could appeal to authority and say, look, the majority of biologists believe in these Darwinian mechanisms. And what I would want to do is say, well, then what are their supporting arguments for this? Just as someone would say, oh, the majority of scholars believe in the empty tomb. What are the supporting arguments on which they form this view? And then one would be able to share those arguments. But you see, my difficulty is that when you ask evolutionary biologists, really, Darwinism is sufficient to explain evolution? What is the evidence for that? What you get are things like the peppered moth and Darwin's finches and
the Stanley Miller experiment, things like that.
Things that simply don't provide adequate foundation for this enormous extrapolation that common descent and evolution is adequately explained by these mechanisms. And so that makes one suspect that the consensus on that point is not based on the evidence, but upon some sort of prior philosophical disposition. And so I'm agnostic with respect to that third point, at least. And as Ayala himself admits, this is a matter of open scientific investigation. There are lots of authorities who don't think these mechanisms are adequate.
What about what he says about a small minority of scientists, the intelligent design theorist or community, largely determined to be pseudoscience? Well, first of all, who is it that's largely considering them to be pseudoscience? And, well, are they?
Yeah, that is really just name-calling. We have to be very careful about that. What you want to see is why are their arguments mistaken, not simply to provide labels of them. And I have found in this debate that all too often it's merely a matter of calling names or labeling one's opponents. It's silly to say that people like Michael Behe and Michael Denton and Guillermo Gonzalez are not scientists. These men publish in peer-reviewed journals. They're professors in various scientific departments at universities. It's silly to say that what they're doing is pseudoscience, unless you've got some sort of argument here, some kind of demarcation argument as to what counts as science and what doesn't count as science. But philosophers of science know that those kind of demarcation arguments are just largely regarded as failures. Nobody has been able to provide a sort of clear set of criteria as to what counts as science and what doesn't count as science. So again, those kind of labels presuppose criteria that, well, need to be demanded, and you need to give us then what are the forthcoming reasons on which you make this judgment.
In conclusion, Dr. Craig, I want to revisit something that he said earlier in his question. He just says that his allegiance is with the skeptics. And often people think that if you are skeptical of everything, that that's somehow more intellectually honest or intellectually rigorous. But it leads to an infinite regress of skepticism. You got to be skeptical of that and that, and skeptical of the criteria for skepticism. And
well, exactly. Why isn't the skeptic skeptical of his own skepticism?
Yeah.
How does he know that he doesn't know anything?
So why side necessarily with the... Why just be skeptical? Because, I mean, if you want to be bohemian and cool, well, I guess so. But that has nothing to do with truth quite often.
Exactly. It doesn't take any brains, Kevin, not to believe something.
You know, and he says something that I just so disagree with. And I guess, look at it. He says, it just seems to me that the skeptics put forth a better case than the apologists. Well, I think that's ridiculous, but I certainly don't think that, you know, in my years of it, but and neither do you.
No, you'd need to ask him again, what case are you referring to?
Yeah, what are you referring to? See, because that's just a broad...
I'm not aware of any such case.
Well, it's a broad brushstroke, but it does bring up the issue, what if you were a person who encountered brilliant skeptics throughout a certain formative period of your life and very dumb or unintelligent or inarticulate Christians?
Yeah.
Would that mean that God therefore doesn't exist because you run into more articulate skeptics? I mean, you know,
more importantly, I mean, clearly that would not imply that God doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Because his existence is an objective fact or not, independent of your historical circumstances. But the difficult question that it would raise, and I think this is his question, is would your being in such a situation exonerate your unbelief? Would it excuse you for your unbelief? Suppose you were raised in the Soviet Union during the 1950s, where all you heard at the university was Marxist propaganda, and the only Christians you met were idiots in the local church in your village. Would you be excused from not believing in God? And I think that what the New Testament teaches is that God is too loving and too powerful to allow people's eternal destiny to hinge in that way on the accidents of history and geography. That if you're in a difficult situation like that, then he's going to provide an internal witness of the Holy Spirit that will be so powerful for those who genuinely seek him that it will simply overpower the arguments of skepticism that you hear from your supposedly brilliant professors.
This is anecdotal, but I've heard so many stories, Bill, that support what you just said. Stories of a girl in atheistic Russia, a hardcore atheist, who God was able to penetrate that atheist culture with some profound things that led her to Christ and led her eventually to an underground church. And stories of Muslims who are so isolated from the gospel, yet God penetrates that. Again, they're anecdotal, but I hear so many from reliable sources on how you're not going to keep God out just because
exactly.
of your geography.
Isn't an all-powerful and all-loving God who wants you to be saved capable of overcoming the disadvantages of your historical and geographical situation? Of course he is. This is hardly surprising that he would be able to provide such an internal conviction of his truth that would overwhelm the arguments that you've heard against it for those who are dispositionally oriented to seek his will and to seek his face.
Thank you so much for listening to Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig, and we'll pick it up there next time and answer some more questions that we receive at reasonablefaith.org. One more time, if you would like to start a Reasonable Faith chapter in your area, information is at reasonablefaith.org. And by the way, if you appreciate the information that you get at reasonablefaith.org and you would like to see these podcasts continue and see us branch out even further, then be a partner with us. You can find out how when you go to reasonablefaith.org. Your financial and prayer support means a great deal to us. That's reasonablefaith.org, and we'll see you next time on Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig.